This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, December 29th, 2011. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, in Syria, security forces fire on protesters while Arab League monitors visit the country. The FDA backs off banning antibiotics in livestock feed, which scientists worry could lead to drug-resistant superbugs. And starting next week, airplanes flying into Europe will have to pay for their carbon pollution, but U.S.-based airlines are fighting the new regulations. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm George Lavender with these headlines for Free Speech Radio News. 17 people have been killed in air raids in South Sudan, according to a military spokesperson who blamed neighboring Sudan for the attacks. The attacks took place in West Bahr el-Ghazal state. Those killed were said to be cattle herders. There have been several confrontations between the two states since South Sudan declared independence from Sudan in July after decades of civil war. The location of the border is among the issues which the two countries still dispute. Today, South Sudan said that it had placed its armed forces on maximum alert along the border. Sudan denied that it carried out the attacks. Protests took place in several Turkish cities today following an air raid Wednesday night in the predominantly Kurdish southeastern province of Şırnak that left 35 people dead. For FSRN, Hermione G. reports from Istanbul.
The airstrike hit a group of about 50 Kurdish villagers who had just crossed into Turkey from northern Iraq. According to the mayor of nearby Uludere, most of the 35 people killed died from burns caused by exploding diesel drums. Turkey's general staff issued a statement saying that the area is used by the outlawed Kurdish armed group, the PKK, to smuggle weapons into Turkey, and the strike was launched after unmanned drones mistook the group for members of the militia. Local officials, however, say the men targeted in Wednesday's attack were only bringing cigarettes and fuel across the border. Raci Bilici is the deputy head of Turkey's Human Rights Association in the Kurdish city of Diyarbakir.
It was an act of brutality. They killed civilians who were just trying to earn some money. They smuggled goods from Iran and Iraq, and the government knows very well that they are people from the area and have nothing to do with the PKK.
The pro-Kurdish Peace and Democracy Party called the attack a massacre and a crime against humanity. The Turkish military stepped up its strikes against the PKK after the Kurdish militia killed 24 Turkish soldiers in October, one of the deadliest attacks since the organization was founded in 1984. So far, over 40,000 people have been killed in the conflict. Hermione G., FSRN, Istanbul.
Egyptian authorities raided the offices of 17 non-governmental organizations in Cairo on Thursday, including at least two prominent U.S. government-backed groups. FSRN's Noel King reports from Cairo.
Egypt's ruling military council said the offices were raided as part of an investigation into the role of foreign hands in the protests which have rocked central Cairo in recent weeks. Several Egyptian NGOs have angered the military-led government for highlighting police and army brutality against peaceful protesters and for demanding an end to the trial of civilians in military tribunals. At least three of the groups raided on Thursday are U.S.-based organizations whose stated aims include the promotion of democracy. Two of them, the National Democratic Institute and the International Republican Institute, are linked to U.S. political parties. Egypt receives $1.3 billion in American aid each year. Washington-based Freedom House was also among the groups raided. David J. Kramer, the president of Freedom House, said today's raids are, quote, an escalation of repression unheard of even during the Mubarak regime, unquote. Egyptian security forces told office workers that they were under investigation by the public prosecutor. Laptops and other documents were seized during the raids. Noel King, FSRN, Cairo.
Kim Jong-un has been declared supreme leader of North Korea today at a memorial service in the capital Pyongyang for his father and former leader Kim Jong-il. Thousands of North Koreans gathered in the city's main square, named after the new leader's grandfather, Kim Il-sung. It was the second day of funeral proceedings for Kim Jong-il, who died of a heart attack 2 weeks ago. The crowd marked a 3-minute silence, after which trains and ships across the country sounded their horns in unison. Kim Jong-un watched the service from a balcony, surrounded by military and government officials. Today's memorial service brings the period of official mourning for the death of Kim Jong-il to an end. Iran has threatened to blockade a key oil supply route if the U.S. issues sanctions against their oil and financial sectors. The U.S. has threatened sanctions in response to Iran's alleged nuclear activities. Today, Iranian state media reported that an Iranian plane had recorded video of U.S. warships in the area. An estimated 1/6 of the world's oil supply passes through the Strait of Hormuz, which links oil-producing states including Bahrain, Kuwait, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia to the Indian Ocean. Iranian officials have said it would be easy to close the strait, which is just 34 miles wide in places. The US Navy's Fifth Fleet said on Wednesday that disruption of the strait would not be tolerated. Fighter jets worth $30 billion will be sold to Saudi Arabia in a deal approved by the Obama administration today. Saudi Arabia will receive 84 new F-15 fighters and upgrades for 70 more. The sale is part of a 10-year, $60 billion arms deal with the kingdom agreed last year that includes F-15s, attack helicopters, and a broad array of missiles, bombs, and delivery systems. The deal is the single largest sale of weapons to a foreign nation in the history of the U.S. In Iowa, five people were arrested this morning for blockading the office of Republican presidential candidate Ron Paul. The group were demonstrating against the congressman's proposal to abolish the Environmental Protection Agency. The protest follows an occupation of Mitt Romney's campaign office and a branch of Wells Fargo yesterday by protesters involved in the Occupy movement. Occupy the Caucasus is planning to go to the campaign headquarters of each Republican candidate, as well as Barack Obama's campaign office, before the weekend. And those are the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. I'm George Lavender.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In Syria today, security forces continue to crack down on protesters, leaving some 40 dead, according to activists and the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. The violence comes despite the presence of monitors from the Arab League, who are on a mission to report on human rights abuses in the country. Since their arrival, the regime of Bashar al-Assad has shown few signs of decreasing the violence that has killed more than 5,000 during the past 10 months. For more, we're joined by Dr. Khaldun al-Aswad. He's with the National Coordination Body, a Syrian opposition group, and a member of the Damascus Center for Theoretical and Civil Rights Studies. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you for having me.
Since the arrival of the Arab League monitors, there seems to be little change in the behavior of the Assad regime. Activists posted videos this week that showed monitors even having to take cover with shots ringing out, protesters fleeing in homes during their visit. Do you see this mission as having credibility or cause for hope in changing the situation?
I definitely see this mission has affected the behavior of the regime slightly. In fact, in Hama, the regime for the first time did not use live bullets the first day. They used water guns and tear gas canisters. But the problem with this mission that the monitors' numbers are limited. There are more than 350 hot points in the whole country of Syria for about 75 monitors. And cities are big, there are large population. The numbers of those monitors need to be increased significantly to be able to control the situation. In addition to that, the Syrian regime never shown regard to the citizens' lives. I think the Syrian regime also shows less regard to Arab monitors' lives sometimes. So the behavior of the Syrian regime is expected.
What about the monitors themselves? The Arab League monitors are supposed to be assessing the situation, the allegations of human rights violations. The man leading the mission, Lieutenant General Mohammed al-Dabi of Sudan, has been criticized earlier this week. He called the findings reassuring, even as protesters were being fired upon by security forces. How do you view his role?
Well, we hoped as a Syrian opposition that his role will be just a coordination between the monitors. I heard that he was given more say in directing the mission than it was supposed to be for a monitor's mission. So we actually voiced our concerns to the Arab League General Assembly and the Arab League Secretary, and we hope his role will be limited to administrative issues in the monitor's mission. So we agree with the criticism about his role and about his assignment. He has been criticized by some international human rights organization about his roles in Sudan, but we hope that by limiting his role to administrative issues, that will overcome this hurdle.
And the role in Sudan you're referring to is his role as a former intelligence advisor to President Omar al-Bashir of Sudan, who is wanted now by the International Criminal Court.
That's actually correct. He was asked to go testify in front of the International Criminal Court, and had he accepted the invitation, he would have a hard time going back to his country. So I heard he refused to go testify against Omar al-Bashir, the current president of Sudan.
You mentioned weighing in and giving your opinion to the Arab League monitors some of your concerns. As a member of the Damascus Center for Theoretical and Civil Rights Studies, are you in any contact, or is your organization in contact with the Arab League?
As part of the Syrian opposition, we are actually in contact with the Arab League. Dr. Haitham Manna, who is the secretary of the National Coordination Body outside Syria, is actually in direct contact with the Arab Leagues on a daily basis. And Arab Leagues actually seeks and solicits our opinion in every step it takes in this crisis.
And what have you heard from people on the ground in Syria about developments this week as the monitors are visiting these towns?
Well, yesterday I got a phone call from one of the activists on the ground I can't identify for his safety, that the people of Daraa thought that the monitors are in the city, so they took to the streets in a peaceful demonstration, and at least two were killed by the security service and scores injured. He estimated the numbers at least 20 to 30 people were injured gravely.
Dr. Khaldun Al-Aswad is with the Damascus Center for Theoretical and Civil Rights Studies. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, and I'm happy to speak to you.
Overuse of antibiotics in livestock is creating drug-resistant strains of bacteria, or superbugs, that pose a serious threat to human health by rendering common antibiotics ineffective. But the federal government is moving to weaken regulations. While public attention was focused on the holidays and Congress's payroll tax cut showdown, the Food and Drug Administration quietly canceled its plans to ban two major antibiotics from livestock feed. The agency said last week it will instead urge pharmaceutical companies to voluntarily restrict sales of their products. Alice Olstein has the story in Washington.
Rather than regulate the use of antibiotics in farm animals, the FDA announced it's asking for voluntary industry reform. The agency will ask the pharmaceutical companies that make the antibiotics to relabel them, so they are only used for treating infected humans and animals. The decision marks a sharp turnaround from the FDA's recent position on antibiotic overuse. In 2010, the agency released an animated video to convince the public of the importance of taking action.
Addressing the issue of antimicrobial resistance is one of the most urgent priorities in the fields of public health today.
Against a background of cartoon amoebas, the video explained,
during the past five decades, the use and sometimes misuse of antimicrobials in both human and veterinary medicine has resulted in the emergence of strains of bacteria that no longer respond to antimicrobial therapy.
Essentially, if the cow that became your hamburger was given a steady diet of antibiotics, the antibiotics your doctor gives you become less effective. Though store packaging often shows animals grazing on a picturesque farm, most U.S. meat is produced in what's called a concentrated animal feeding operation, or CAFO. With animals packed in together and eating industrial corn-based feed, diseases are inevitable, and species bred for enormous size and weight are particularly vulnerable. So in addition to using antibiotics to treat animals once they get sick, many farmers feed them to all their livestock preemptively. According to the FDA, U.S. livestock producers bought nearly 42 million pounds of antibiotics in 2010 alone, about 80% of all antibiotics sold. Dr. Lance Price at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health says we can only expect an increase in disease outbreaks if livestock antibiotic use continues at its current rate.
We're really barreling towards what we call the post-antibiotic era in medicine. And that's a sad day for all of us because, you know, as soon as we see the emergence of these bacteria that are resistant to all of the drugs that we have, you know, people are going to begin to start dying of bacterial infections that were easily treatable with antibiotics.
This April, turkey burgers contaminated with antibiotic-resistant salmonella infected 12 people across 10 different states. And just last week, the Center for Disease Control reported an outbreak of antibiotic-resistant salmonella traced back to ground beef. 16 people in 7 different states are infected. Price says the situation demands a complete overhaul of how our meat is produced.
If you've designed a food animal production system that's built on the crutch of antibiotics, that you can't produce animals without having disease without this constant input of antibiotics, then that system is broken.
The Keep Antibiotics Working Coalition is currently suing the FDA for failing to keep unsafe drugs off the market. The group is also lobbying meat purchasers to refuse to buy from farms that put antibiotics in their animal feed. Roach says voluntary reforms alone won't get the job done.
The problem with the voluntary approach is it depends on the pharmaceutical companies taking actions that go against their direct economic interests, because if there's to be a public health benefit, they need to reduce the amount of sales. There's no good reason to expect that a company is going to voluntarily reduce sales of their products because the FDA asked them to do so nicely.
Meanwhile, the Preservation of Antibiotics for Medical Treatment Act has been introduced in the House and Senate, but the current gridlock on Capitol Hill gives advocates little hope for a legislative victory. Some countries in the world have already taken action. The European Union banned antibiotics in animal feed in 2006, and South Korea made a similar pledge earlier this year. But in our globalized food system, where meat and produce is shipped around the world, antibiotic resistance can only be curbed if all countries get on board. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Europe has the world's most ambitious cap and trade system for cutting greenhouse gas emissions. For 6 years now, thousands of factories and power plants have had to reduce their emissions or pay for their excess carbon pollution. Starting January 1st, airlines and air cargo companies must join the program, including foreign carriers that land at European airports. But countries, including the U.S., who have airlines flying into Europe, are resisting the program. The issue is shaping up to become an international showdown over what it means to get serious about global warming. From France, FSRN's Liam Moriarty reports.
Steve Lott and his colleagues are not happy with Europe these days.
We believe that the EU emissions trading scheme, as proposed, is not only illegal under international treaty and international law, but it's also bad policy.
Lott is with Airlines for America, the trade group for the U.S. airlines industry. The group filed a lawsuit against the EU for requiring non-European airlines to meet the continent's greenhouse gas emissions targets or pay up. And while they say it's illegal to force them to take part in the EU program, Europe's highest court last week upheld the law. Nonetheless, Lott says the Europeans are going about it backwards.
The aviation industry, different from, say, a factory or a power plant, emits across international borders and emits across the globe. So a global industry needs a global approach when it comes to emissions and the environment.
The U.S. government agrees. State Department spokeswoman Victoria Nuland told a press briefing in Washington last week that the U.S. was disappointed that the European court upheld the EU plan to force foreign aviation into its emissions program.
There are mechanisms in international aviation for addressing the question of greenhouse gas emissions, and that's where these things should be talked about.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton recently sent a stern letter urging the European Commission to drop the January 1st deadline. If not, she warned, the U.S. would be compelled to take appropriate action. This kind of diplomatic saber-rattling has been coming from a growing number of other countries as well. China, India, Russia, Brazil, and others have threatened trade sanctions or other retaliation if the Europeans proceed. Meanwhile, European airlines are nervous. They fear they'll take the brunt of any foreign sanctions. They're also worried that if foreign carriers refuse to comply, they'll be left at a competitive disadvantage. They want the EU to go back to working on a global emissions program. If EU officials are feeling the heat, they're not showing it. Climate Action Commissioner Connie Hedegaard recently said there was no way Europe would back down from its climate policy. But given the intense and widespread opposition, why doesn't Europe just work on that international solution everybody's talking about? Bill Hemming says that's a good idea as far as it goes.
But that doesn't mean, in the meantime, Europe should drop tools and do nothing.
Hemmings is with Transport and Environment, a Brussels-based environmental group. He points out that it was 1997 when ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization, was tasked by the UN with crafting a global agreement for cutting greenhouse gases from airplanes. 14 years later, he says, there's little to show for it.
They ruled out fuel taxation even before the Kyoto Treaty. They then ruled out a levy. They ruled out efficiency standards for new aircraft. They ruled out in 2004 a global emissions trading system.
In short, Hemming says, the aviation industry has shown it's simply not serious about climate change. ICAO did agree last year to a goal of capping aviation carbon emissions in 2020. The industry counters that aviation is a minor factor in climate change, accounting for only 3% of the world's greenhouse gas output. But Torben Krentz with Concedo, a green think tank in Copenhagen, says that's misleading.
3% is quite a lot, actually.
Krentz points out that all the personal cars in the world contribute just 6% of global carbon emissions. He says research has also shown that aviation emissions have a disproportionate greenhouse gas impact. They're emitted high in the atmosphere, they create a lot of water vapor, they form ozone, so they do more damage than other emissions. Krentz also says that industry assertions that aircraft fuel efficiency has dramatically increased are true, but
people are flying more and more, and the reduction in the emission is lower than the expansion of flying. So the total emission is going up.
In fact, aviation emissions are growing faster than any other industrial sector. All of which leads Bill Hemmings from Transport and Environment to conclude that Europe is right to stick to its guns.
The clock is ticking, and if drastic action is not taken to keep global warming increase below 2 degrees, then the next generation is going to be in serious trouble.
The Paris-based International Energy Agency last month issued a report saying the world is on track to pass that point of no return by 2017. Liam Moriarty, FSRN, Normandy, France.
FSRN staff and reporters
would like to wish all of our listeners a happy new year and holiday season.
Listeners like you are the reason we work hard
to bring stories from the U.S. and international grassroots to the forefront.
From our collective to your family,
thank you for all your support over the years.
And here's to another year of listener-powered independent journalism.
Learn more about it at fsrn.org.
In Myanmar, there have been signs of political reform under the military-backed civilian government of President Thein Sein. Some, including Western leaders, have welcomed the changes in the Southeast Asian country, also known as Burma. But hundreds of political prisoners remain in detention, media control is tight, and on the border with Thailand, home to more than 100,000 refugees, many aren't convinced reforms will come swiftly enough. FSRN's Ron Corbin reports.
At the May Tower Clinic in the border town of Mae Sot, medical staff are treating residents from the refugee camp. On one day each week, children are immunized against hepatitis and given treatments for respiratory infections, malaria and anemia. Each year, more than 100,000 patients come to the clinic and the staff knows the community well. Cynthia Meung, a Karen doctor who set up the clinic 20 years ago, says there has been growing optimism among the refugee community over the outlook for Myanmar, with the reforms now taking place.
Generally, we can say that people on the border here, they're very excited about the political change. At the same time, people want to see the progress. The political progress, because of they know about some dialogue going on the political prisoner release.
Dr. Meung says many support the steps to political reform, but she says they also want more expansive changes and more civic participation in politics. Since coming to office in March, President Thein Sein has set Myanmar on the path of reform. Pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi, imprisoned for almost 15 years, is now playing a greater role in Myanmar's political life, and officials freed about 300 political prisoners. But the government still imprisons hundreds of dissidents. Tet Nyung works with the Assistance Association for Political Prisoners and is a former political prisoner himself.
I can see that the reforms will be harder. And for the more future reforms to occur, the reforms depend on Aung San Suu Kyi and NLD party persuade or push the Burmese government or opposition groups or activist groups inside Burma persuade or push or involved with the politics in Burma to push the government to launch off reforms. And at the same time, the internationals pressure on the Burmese government to do more reforms.
Tet Nyung says he wants to see the release of the remaining 1,600 political prisoners. Government repression and decades of conflict has also created the refugee crisis. An estimated 120,000 refugees still remain in seven camps along the border with Thailand. Tens of thousands have been resettled to third countries such as the United States, Europe and Australia. Father Robert Twai is chair of the Karen Refugee Committee.
For the refugees in along the border in here, every month the people increase. They are coming from inside Burma. And also, because if I tell you friendly, some of the people also maybe they are real refugees. But some of the people, they are not real refugees, because the problem only they want to for resettlement. Now you will see in the camp, we had from Arakan, Rohingya, Shan, Ching, Kachin, Lahu, and also in India, Mon, Karen, many people is coming.
While some refugees hope to make a home far from Myanmar, others wish to return to the country. Again, Dr. Meung.
The suffering of the local community or Burmese people and the displacement and the poverty and the human rights violation, we could not see any improvement or even worse. So people are really excited and people want to go back home safely and secure and with dignity.
Tensions were heightened recently following the Myanmar army's attacks on Kachin communities along the border. This and other pressing human rights concerns has made some more cautious over the outlook. Lynn Yoshikawa from the Washington-based Refugees International says the chance for refugees to return to the eastern provinces of Myanmar is still some time away.
I think that it's great that the discussion is starting, but the potential for the refugees in Thailand to be able to return to eastern Burma remains very distant. Regardless of the political situation, you know, the extent of landmines there is incredible, and no one really knows actually where they are.
Yoshikawa warns there appears to be a considerable disconnect between the optimism among civil society in Yangon and the harsh realities of the refugee community along the border with Thailand. She hopes leaders pay attention to providing housing, jobs and economic opportunities for refugees returning home. Ron Corbin, FSRN, Maysot Township, on the Thai-Myanmar border.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Molly Stent, sitting in for Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.